From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Middle East is going to be nuclearized in no time. And I think that the solution should be a regional agreement. The Middle East should be nuclear free, including Israel. And I think this has to be part of a regional agreement.
Leading Israeli columnist Akiva Eldar on nuclear weapons in the Middle East, Iran, and the influence of the Israel lobby in the United States. We'll also look at the forgotten war in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
There's another form of very violent war with sexual terrorism going on in Congo. We are talking about more than, in all eastern part of Congo, more than 200,000 women, children and babies being raped every day.
But first, how will the newly released government torture memos affect the confirmation hearing of Attorney General nominee Michael Mukasey? All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. An official Iraqi government investigation has accused forces from the private military company Blackwater of committing deliberate murder when it shot and killed 17 Iraqis last month in Baghdad. Iraq says the Blackwater guards must be punished accordingly. Meanwhile, the State Department has announced it will continue to use Blackwater guards in Iraq, but that the private soldiers will be put under tighter controls. Cameras will be placed in their convoys, and diplomatic security agents will accompany convoys protected by Blackwater. Blackwater is also coming under pressure here in the United States. Over 300 people rallied Sunday to protest Blackwater's plans to open an 800-acre military training base east of San Diego. Meanwhile, it's been revealed Blackwater recently hired a public relations firm with ties to Senator Hillary Clinton. A subsidiary of the PR firm Burson Marsteller helped Blackwater founder Eric Prince prepare for his recent testimony before Congress. The president of Burson Marsteller's, Mark Penn, the chief strategist for Clinton's presidential campaign. The commander of U.S. forces in Iraq, General David Petraeus, has stepped up accusations Iran is inciting violence in Iraq. Over the weekend, Petraeus accused the Iranian ambassador in Iraq of being a member of the Quds Force, a unit of Iran's Revolutionary Guard. Petraeus provided no evidence to support his claim. Petraeus said, quote, there should be no question about the malign, lethal involvement and activities of the Quds Force in this country. Last month, Petraeus accused Iran of providing arms to Shia militias in Iraq. Petraeus has been accused of ratcheting up the rhetoric against Tehran in preparation for military strikes in Iran. On Friday, in an interview with the Arabic network Al Arabiya, President Bush dismissed reports the U.S. is preparing plans to possibly attack Iran. Bush called the reports empty propaganda and baseless, but he didn't rule out a U.S. strike.
I, of course, said all options are on the table, but I made a pledge to the American people that we will work diplomatically to solve the problem. And that's why you see us at the United Nations working with the EU countries and China and Russia to send that clear message, and that we're going to continue to impose sanctions and make it harder for the Iranian government to operate in the world until they change their mind.
In other news from Iraq, more than 1,000 Iraqis marched in West Baghdad to protest the U.S. military's decision to build a concrete wall around their neighborhood. The U.S. plans to wall off at least 5 neighborhoods in Baghdad in order to separate Sunnis and Shiites. This comes as the Washington Post reports several top Iraqi leaders have lost faith in achieving national reconciliation. Iraqi leaders argue sectarian animosity is entrenched in the structure of their government. Meanwhile, Iraqi officials have accused the U.S. of killing at least 17 Iraqi civilians, including women and children, in multiple helicopter airstrikes near Baquba on Friday. At least 4 houses were destroyed. One Iraqi army official said many of the civilians were killed when they rushed out to help those hurt in the initial bombing. In news from Afghanistan, 1 U.S. soldier and 4 Afghan civilians died Saturday when a suicide car bomber attacked an American military convoy in Kabul. Dozens of shops were damaged in the blast. The bombing occurred on the eve of the 6th anniversary of the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan. It was the 3rd major attack in Kabul in a week. The United Nations recently revealed violence has reached a new high in Afghanistan. Over 5,000 people have been killed so far in 2007. This year is also on pace to be the deadliest year of the war for U.S. troops. 87 American soldiers have died so far, with a record 50,000 troops now in Afghanistan. It appears the U.S. is planning for a long stay. The U.S. military recently began expanding the American base at Bagram. New barracks are being built to help accommodate the record number of U.S. troops in the country. Colonel Jonathan Ives said, quote, "This is going to become a long-term base for us. Whether that means 5 years, 10 years, we don't know." Meanwhile, opium production has reached a new high in Afghanistan. The New York Times reports U.S. officials are trying to persuade the Afghan government to begin spraying herbicide on opium poppies. Pakistan is in a state of political turmoil after Saturday's presidential vote. General Pervez Musharraf won an overwhelming majority of the vote because of a boycott by almost the entire opposition. However, Pakistan's Supreme Court has yet to decide whether Musharraf was even eligible to stand for re-election while retaining his post as army chief. The court won't decide until at least October 17th. The Bush administration's continuing to reject calls by congressional Democrats to release a series of secret legal opinions effectively sanctioning the use of torture. On Friday, President Bush defended his administration's interrogation policy.
Find somebody who may have information regarding a potential attack on America, you bet we're going to detain them. And you bet we're going to question them. Because the American people expect us to find out information, actionable intelligence, so we can help them, help protect them. That's our job. Secondly, this government does not torture people. You know, we stick to U.S. law and our international obligations.
Meanwhile, the Washington Post reports a group of World War II interrogators gathered Friday at Fort Hunt and criticized the Bush administration's interrogation practices. 90-year-old Henry Colmes said, quote, "We got more information out of a German general with a game of chess or ping pong than they do today with their torture." One of the World War II veterans refused to accept honors from the Army's Freedom Team salute, citing his opposition to what's happened at Guantanamo and in Iraq. UN Special Envoy to Burma, Ibrahim Gambari, told the Security Council Friday the military junta in Burma is continuing to crack down on pro-democracy activists and monks following a wave of protests.
To the United Nations and the international community are the continuing and disturbing reports of abuses being committed by security and non-uniform elements, particularly at night during curfew, including raids on private homes, beatings, arbitrary arrests and disappearances.
On Saturday, demonstrations were held across the globe in solidarity with the pro-democracy activists in Burma. Bo Thak Tint of the Burmese government in exile spoke in Washington.
Our people are peace-loving, justice-loving. They all the time they are seeking for the negotiated political settlement through the dialogue under the leadership of Aung San Suu Kyi. But now, because of the brutal, you know, crackdown against the peaceful monks and student leadership, the people outrages across the nation as well as across the world. Not only Burmese, but also across the world, all the friends of Burma asking military dictator to stop now.
In Egypt, 23 independent and opposition daily newspapers refused to publish on Sunday to protest a government clampdown on journalists. Seven journalists were recently sentenced to up to 2 years in prison for criticizing Hosni Mubarak's government. Journalists in Egypt can be jailed for writings that are deemed insulting to the president or state institutions, such as parliament or the cabinet. In Costa Rica, voters went to the polls Sunday to decide whether Costa Rica should sign the Central American Free Trade Agreement with the United States. With returns in from 95% of polling stations, the trade deal appears to have been passed by a narrow margin. Opponents of the deal say they won't recognize the results until a manual recount is done. In Wisconsin, an off-duty sheriff's deputy in the town of Crandon shot dead six people Saturday night. Tyler Peterson reportedly burst into his ex-girlfriend's house and opened fire. The victims ranged in age from 14 to 20. Forest County Sheriff Keith Van Cleve confirmed Sunday Peterson was one of his deputies.
The shooter was a full-time Forest County deputy. He was off-duty at the time of the shooting. He also worked part-time for the city.
After a massive manhunt, a sniper shot Peterson dead on Sunday. A judge in Washington state has granted an emergency stay to postpone the second court-martial of First Lieutenant Aaron Watada, which was slated to begin Tuesday. Ouattara was the first U.S. Army officer to refuse to fight in the Iraq War. His first court-martial ended in a mistrial. Ouattara's lawyers argued a second court-martial would amount to trying him twice for the same charges, double jeopardy. Police in Denver, Colorado, arrested 83 protesters Saturday after demonstrators blocked the city's annual Columbus Day parade. Prior to their arrest, protesters poured fake blood on the streets to represent the genocide of indigenous people that began after Columbus sailed to the Americas. American Indian activists Russell Means and Glenn Morris were among the arrested. And three stem cell researchers have won the 2007 Nobel Prize for Medicine. Mario Capecchi, Martin Evans, and Oliver Smithies have been pioneers in the new branch of medicine known as gene targeting. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Bush administration's continuing to reject calls by congressional Democrats to release a series of secret legal opinions effectively sanctioning the use of torture. The New York Times revealed last week the Justice Department, under former Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, secretly issued the memos that reportedly authorized methods including head slapping, simulated drowning, and frigid temperatures. The first opinion came shortly after Gonzalez arrived in February 2005. Just months earlier, the Justice Department had publicly declared torture abhorrent. The showdown on Capitol Hill over the release of the documents comes as the Senate Judiciary Committee prepares for confirmation hearings for U.S. Attorney General nominee Michael Mukasey. The hearings could begin as early as October 17th. President Bush officially nominated Mukasey, a retired federal judge, on September 17th. Committee Chair Patrick Leahy says he will seek Mukasey's opinion on the firing of nine U.S. attorneys, the Bush administration's secret domestic wiretapping program, and a list of what he called other topics of concern. Shana Carrido is a staff attorney for the Center for Constitutional Rights here in New York. He works on CCR's case on the illegal NSA domestic spying program, as well as the Center's Patriot Act case. He's a regular contributor to the Huffington Post. Shana joins us now in our Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy
Now! Good morning, Amy. Thanks for having me.
Can you talk about the significance of the torture memos that we have now seen, not because the government has released them to Congress, but because the New York Times revealed them, and how this relates to the confirmation hearing for Judge Mukasey?
Sure. Well, you know, the reality is the Times has talked to government officials who've seen the memos. They haven't actually seen the memos. And so the release of the actual memos, there are two of them, one saying that the torture prohibitions in the Constitution and various treaties don't apply to the CIA, and another one sort of defining torture. You know, no one's seen them. And so, you know, whether or not they're released to Congress, that's going to be a huge issue for the new attorney general to deal with. And, you know, I assume that the Democrats are going to ask Mukasey whether or not he's willing to release these.
Mm-hmm. Talk about who Judge Mukasey is, why you're blogging about him, and, well, then we'll talk about the kind of questions that could be asked in the confirmation hearing.
Sure. Well, you know, it's a little bit of self-interest. You know, one of the key things I think that, you know, we should be concerned about with Mukasey is that he hates the legal left. He's come after the Center for Constitutional Rights in, you know, his op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal about a month before he was nominated.
Explain.
Oh, sure. Well, you know, Michael Ratner, the president of the center, shortly after lawyers started going down to Guantanamo, did an interview with Mother Jones Magazine in which he said, you know, look, lawyers are going to go down there, talk to detainees, and they're going to confirm stories of torture that we've heard already, you know, Abu Ghraib-style things happening at Guantanamo. And he said, you know, look, you can't run a torture and interrogation camp with lawyers going down there. And in Mukasey's reading, that's become, you can't run an interrogation camp with lawyers going down there. He said in the journal, the director of an organization purporting to protect constitutional rights has announced that his goal is to unleash a flood of lawyers on Guantanamo so as to paralyze the interrogation of detainees. And he's come after the American Library Act for protesting the Patriot Act. He's clearly,
American Library Association.
Right, right. And, you know, he's clearly a guy, I think, who has distaste for people who, you know, voice skepticism about the government's motives in the war on terror, which is a troubling thing for a federal judge to sort of feel.
Can you talk about his role in the Jose Padilla case?
Sure. Well, Jose Padilla was a U.S. citizen, is a U.S. citizen, who was arrested at O'Hare Airport. And the Justice Department's initial sort of account of who he was that he was coming here to the U.S. To plant a dirty bomb somewhere. So real serious allegations. This all happened right after 9/11. And he ended up in Mukasey's courtroom, first detained as a material witness, which meant they weren't charging him with anything. They just wanted to keep him so he could testify in someone else's proceeding. And then as an enemy combatant, which is kind of this completely newfangled category of military detainee. And, you know, some people on the left were excited when Mukasey was nominated because, you know, first, he wasn't a Bush administration insider like Alberto Gonzalez. But moreover, they felt that he had given Padilla a pretty, you know, balanced sort of deal that, you know, he had said you have the right to see a lawyer, for instance. But the reality is that you know, this case that he decided, which was pretty shortly after 9/11, maybe within the first year, said that the president has a right to hold people as military detainees, that somebody like Padilla, who ordinarily would have to be charged with a crime because he was a U.S. citizen, because he was arrested in the U.S. at minimum, that the executive can just hold him by designating him an enemy combatant. And Mukasey set a very low standard for what the president has to show. You know, so people on the left look at that case and they think, well, Mukasey said that, you know, an enemy combatant can get into U.S. court. But the reality is that it would have been a very short stay in court. And then he did say that you are allowed to see a lawyer as an enemy combatant, but he said that the military could listen in on your conversations with the lawyer. And in fact, Jose Padilla didn't see a lawyer for 3 years when he was held as an enemy combatant.
What are the questions you think that the senator should ask?
Sure. Well, I think, you know, they should really probe into his views on key war on terror issues. You know, is it acceptable for the president to hold detainees without any form of review from federal judges? Is torture ever acceptable and what are the boundaries on it? You know, and is he going to be willing to do real investigations of misconduct of this administration, perhaps by appointing a special prosecutor? Now, Newsweek reported that during Mukasey's White House interview for the job that he, you know, gave answers to all three of those questions that are things that the administration would be pleased to hear, that he thinks we should be allowed to hold people outside of the court process, that torture is acceptable for certain, you know, sort of high-value detainees, and that he voiced skepticism about whether it was wise to appoint a special prosecutor.
Can you talk about the significance Friday, the U.S. military's chief prosecutor for the Guantanamo war crimes trials resigning, Air Force Colonel Davis?
Sure. Well, it shows what a mess this entire system has been. You know, the military is making up rules as it goes along for trying these you know, so-called terror suspects. In fact, some of the charges are things that were created after the violations that supposedly occurred. You know, we're seeing ex post facto charges, really, against a lot of these guys. And this is just another symptom of making up the rules as you go along.
They say that he was clashing with the Pentagon. They wanted him to bring war crimes prosecutions in a sensational way.
Right. And he felt, you know, his supervisors were interfering with his role as a prosecutor. You know, prosecutors do work for the executive. In this case, he's a military prosecutor, but they're also supposed to exercise independent judgment. You know, the founders thought about putting the Justice Department in the judicial branch instead of the executive in order to ensure a little distance from the president. And this is another example of, you know, things that go wrong when there's interference from above.
How important is Judge Mukasey as Attorney General? What will he be determining over these next few years?
Oh, well, you know, among other things, the Office of Legal Counsel, which gives the president legal advice, which wrote all these torture memos, that's part of the Justice Department. So he would have final oversight over the people who are, you know, at OLC and that sort of thing. Beyond that, he'll be deciding on who to prosecute on interpretations of federal law generally that bind the executive branch. So it's a hugely important position. And I think in some ways he's a brilliant choice by Bush. You know, he doesn't appear to be an insider, but he's someone who agrees with all their positions on executive power.
Shana Kadidal, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Staff attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York. He is a regular contributor to the Huffington Post. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Back in a minute.
Mama Ngalula, eh, Mama Ngalula, Ngalula. poyo linganga na tekinzo topo na bala yo mama ngalula e mama ngalula ngalula e mama ngalula
The Congolese group Elian's Jazz here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush made a strong statement about rape and genocide at a UN Security Council meeting on September 25th.
Maybe some don't think it's genocide, but if you've been raped, you think it's the human your human rights have been violated. If you're mercilessly killed by roaming bands, you know it's genocide.
President Bush was talking about the violence in Darfur, Sudan, but he made no mention of another crisis in Africa, the long and ongoing wars in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Between 1997 and 2004, up to 4 million people died in the conflict. That's according to the latest mortality survey carried out by the International Rescue Committee and published in the British medical journal Lancet. The IRC also estimates today, 3 years later, 38,000 people continue to die each month. Today, we focus on a particularly brutal aspect of the ongoing war in the DRC, the war against women. Speaking to the New York Times, John Holmes, the UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, called the sexual violence in the Congo, quote, the worst in the world. Christine Schuler de Shriver is a Congolese human rights activist. She lives in Bukavu, in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo, where the violence against women is the worst. She came into our Firehouse studio last month. I asked her to describe the situation in her country.
In Congo, since 10 years ago, a war started in 96. After the genocide in Rwanda in 94, all the one who made the genocide arrived in Congo and stayed there in camps. And in 96, when the war started, they went out from the camps and went inside the forest. And then they started killing and raping the Congolese population. 3 years ago, we had a report from International Rescue Committee that already 4 million people died in Congo. So it's one of the most...
4 million?
4 million. And it was 3 years ago, in 2004. And now we are waiting for the new report. I think for beginning October, it will probably be 7 million or more. And nobody is talking about this silent war that's going on in Congo. Because the official war ended 3 years ago. We had elections last year. There's another form of very violent war with sexual terrorism going on in Congo. We are talking about more than, in all eastern part of Congo, more than 200,000 women, children and babies being raped every day. And now, right now, when I'm talking to you, thousands of women are taken and children in the forest as slave sex. And today,
as sex slaves,
yeah. And we are not. I'm sorry, just to talk like this. We are not talking about normal rapes anymore. We are talking about sexual terrorism because they destroyed and they. You cannot imagine what's going on. What's going on in Congo? Rape is a taboo. I think in most of African countries. So the woman who accept to go. It's because to go to the hospital or to be registered. It's because they don't have a choice anymore. They have to go and be repaired because we are talking about new surgery to repair the woman because they're completely destroyed. And the one who are just rape without big destruction, they don't talk about rape because the Congolese woman, she suffered so much that she can support being raped without telling it when she doesn't need medical care.
But the medical care you're talking about is what?
Very, very heavy surgery. We have some women, for example, this Panzi hospital close to Bukavu town.
Bukavu is where you live?
Bukavu, yeah, it's where I live. It's eastern part of Congo, just at the border of Rwanda, 5 minutes walking. And we do have an hospital that is very specialized in rape because of...
this is the Panzi Hospital.
Panzi Hospital. And... I forgot the idea was...
And the women who come to this hospital, what... They have been raped and they have been physically...
Destroyed.
How?
Yeah.
What is the operation? What is the... And what is the... what is the operation that they go through?
The operation, today we are talking about repair surgery, because this woman has to be repaired. They are not just rape, like usual rape. They put hot plastics inside the organs, they put woods, they put bamboos, they put... everything.
Guns.
Guns. They shot inside the woman, so they are completely destroyed. We have some survivors in this hospital since more than 3 years. So every 2 months or every 3 months, they have to be reoperated again, and it's impossible, you know, to keep all these women in this hospital. We don't have room anymore.
They suffer from fistula. Can you explain what that is?
I'm not a doctor. It's quite very difficult. But I know that when they have fistula, it's like, you know, instead of everything, urine and fix, everything comes out.
They're completely incontinent.
You cannot control. You're out of control. So these people smell very bad, and they have infections, and they cannot live, you know, in communities, and they have to be to be repaired by
heavy
surgery.
So they can't control their urine or their bowel movement, and so
not at all. So everything just go out when they're walking, when they're sleeping. It's just
they become pariahs in their communities.
Yeah, of course. And also, you have to know that in your community, when they know you are raped, you're fired from the village. They stigmatize you, and also the husband, if he survives, he will just ask you to leave, and most of the time with the children.
Who established Panzi Hospital?
Panzi Hospital is established by a community of a church. A church, and lots of help we do have. It's from European Union, UNICEF, and also a Swedish NGO. Yeah.
And there the women come, they are operated on, and they live there?
The most lucky one who can reach Panzi Hospital, because, you know, Congo is it's a huge country. So every time, permanently, we can have 250 raped women. The worst of the worst one. And can you imagine when a woman has to eat surgery? So we have to find houses around the hospital for them to stay and wait and to wait for the surgery. It's impossible for them to stay there. That's the reason we really need to have a roof, to have a house where all these women can stay while waiting the operation.
What is the Kabila government doing about this? Do they know?
I think everybody in Congo, everybody know what's going on. But I think they didn't, you know, everything. They have problems everywhere, and they did not know where to put priorities. And priority in Congo was, of course, security of people, because now they're just talking in Congo about the new contracts, and especially with the Chinese who are coming in Congo, like, my goodness, it's like in Far West. So people are just interested in signing this big mines contract and everything, but nobody cares about the population. Even if we see the budget the government has, there's nothing for the raped woman. Nothing for all these people.
You took Mrs. Kabila through the hospital, through Panzi Hospital?
Mrs. Kabila came last October to visit the hospital. And she promised to come back and help. But we are still waiting. As I said, the problems in Congo, it's everywhere. So they have to know where priorities is. As long as we have raped babies, raped grandmothers.
Babies.
The last baby who was raped, it was in April. She was 10 months old. So a very small baby. She was raped. The same gang raped the mother during 2 weeks. And then they came to Bukavu, into my office. I wanted to bring the baby to the hospital, but she was so injured, she died in my arms. 10 months, can you imagine that? And these people, these women in Congo, are just begging for life, not begging for money, just the right to live in their country safely.
Who is doing this?
The one who are doing this, they're 60%, because we made studies, 60% is committed by these people who made the genocide in Rwanda, by Rwandans, the Hutu, the one who made the genocide. And, you know, we talk to women, and sometimes these people who made this can tell them, you know, we died in 94 in Rwanda, so now we don't care about what we're doing. So 60% of these rapes are made by these Rwandan Hutu who made the genocide in their country.
There are supposedly peace talks that are going on. Foreign ministers from the Great Lakes countries failed to make progress in 2 days of talks in Uganda. The latest news, no solution has been agreed on how to deal with the dissident general Laurent Nkunda, whose forces were at war with the Congolese authorities. How does this figure into what you are describing?
You know, I'm just sorry to say that it's one more meeting, and I think these meetings are just going on because of the international pressure. But the consequences, I'm sure, it will be nothing. Like General Nkunda, he has an international mandate against him. But everybody, every journalist who go to Goma, it's north part of Bukavu, can go and interview him. He's like a king there. He become a pastor. So is that normal? This impunity.
How do these rapes take place? What happens in a village? How do the women, how do the girls, the babies get taken?
They usually come at the end of the day or during the night. They just come and circle the villages. Most of the time they killed all the men. And they take all the children, the girls, the mothers, the grandmothers, as sex slaves into the forest and steal, what can I say, everything they have, just maybe a goat or a chicken, and take them and use them as slaves, sex slaves and slaves to work for them in the forest.
Christine, how did you get involved with this human rights work?
I don't know if it was my destiny, but the first raped woman was my best friend. She was like my sister. It was in 98. She was colored like me, so not black, not white, and no political position. And she was raped in such a... I cannot describe the violence, because after she was raped by more than 20 men, and after she was killed, we found more than 100 holes with knives in her body. And the husband has to assist. He was Canadian, and then they killed the husband. So that was the first case in 98. And then we thought maybe it was an accident.
Where did she live?
In Goma, northern part of Bukavu. And then in 2000, when they brought me that little girl, she was 18 months old.
What were you doing at the time?
I was working just like administration, you know, in my office. But when they brought me this young child, 18 months, with broken legs, who was raped for 2 months, then I knew, my goodness, there's a problem going on in Congo. And of course she died. It was impossible to save her. And then at that time I say something is wrong in this country. And the two solutions I had is just to take my suitcase, my children, and leave this hell, or to try to change something in Congo. And I chose the first one, the second one, to try to make an international lobbying and to try to help these people the way I could, because it's not so easy, you know, to find help. The problems in Congo were so huge.
How do you protect yourself?
I'm not really protecting myself, because I cannot live with bodyguards around me. I know I'm in danger, because The war I started against these people, I do receive lots of letters to tell me that it will be my turn soon and things like that. But I don't want to know what's going on around me. I'm just focusing in helping people the way I can, like denouncing and trying to find some funds to help them. And I don't know, maybe the one is protecting me. It's my father who died some years ago, or my best friend who was killed, the first one. So,
how can people help here?
People can help me, first of all, being our ambassador, you know, talking about the problem that's going on in Congo, because it's a silent war. It's like silent. They're killing, they're raping babies and women in Congo. It's to talk about, you know, it's like Darfur. Darfur started 4 years ago. I don't want to compare, you know, problems we have in this world. But Congo, it started almost 11 years ago. And nobody's talking about this femicide, this Holocaust.
Femicide.
Yeah, it's a femicide because they are just destroying the female species, if I can talk like this. Because can you imagine now, in Africa, woman is the heart of family. She's doing everything. Babies, looking for food, looking for the whole family. And now they're destroying this resource. Also, can you imagine with this massive rape AIDS? How will be the population in, for example, in 10 years? And these children who are teenagers now, who just know violence, seeing murdered the family, raped the sister, the mother. What's the next generation? So for me, the most important thing now is that the international community to realize that there's an Holocaust, to wake up and try to change something. Because even the war we had in Congo, it was like an African world war, because so many countries were involved. But it was not a Congolese war, Congolese against Congolese. It was some countries who came and invade Congo with the help, of course, of the international community to come and steal everything out from Congo. And now we are asking for the international community reparation. Not for money, but to be involved to try to find solution. Rwanda to take back these people, these genocidaire, and also Congo to prioritize security of the population.
Has Mrs. Kabila called you ever since October coming to Panzi Hospital?
She called me before I came here, and I think now she asked me to think about what we can do concretely to help this woman, because I think also she noticed that the pressure is also coming from everywhere. Because first of all, the Congolese, and I think the First Lady and the President and the institution we have now, they have to be involved even before the international community. They have at least to show a sign to say we are there, we would like to change. Maybe they can ask for help, but they have to show that they have this will to change this thing.
Are you afraid to go back home as you leave here to get on a plane?
No, I'm not afraid at all to go back home. You know, even if I'm here, my heart is in Africa. So I'm just going home. I will be happy to see my family there, and also all these women to Panzi Hospital. And no, my place is in Congo. So not afraid at all to go back home.
If people wanted to help Panzi Hospital,
we are just begging for a roof. So we would like, with V-Day and UNICEF, to make what we will call the City of Joy. It's just for 100 women to have a roof where to stay while waiting for these heavy surgeries. Or we do have, for example, very young raped mother. Their mothers, they're 13 years old. They lost all the family, so they don't even know where to go. Instead of going, you know, on the road and be prostitutes to survive, we would like we are just begging to have enough funds to build our city of joy. We'll work, of course, closely with the hospital, of Panzi. Because if you see a woman, for example, also this very old woman, when they're safe enough, you know, to go back home, and they're just crying not to leave the hospital because they are there, they feel secure. It's really breaking our hearts. So priority now, in 2008, we would like to have this house for the survivors.
Where can people get more information? Online?
On V-Day.
Eve Ensler's international organization.
Yeah, of course. She came in Bukavu some months ago. She's an amazing woman. And she was so moved at what she heard and what she saw. When she heard, she could not even imagine that today we can talk about cannibalism, having women witnessed how they ate their children, the food they were cooking like every day for them was their own children, and some horror you cannot even talk about. So she was moved, and I think she really wanted also to move the entire world for them to try to change something in Congo.
Christine Schuler de Shriver, Congolese human rights activist. She lives in Bukavu, in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo, where the violence against women is the worst. I spoke to her when she came to New York. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute. Invincible, No Compromises, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The University of St. Thomas in Minnesota has canceled Nobel Peace Prize-winning South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu's scheduled appearance next year. School officials say they're barring Tutu because of previous statements he's made, quote, against Israeli policy. Tutu has compared Israel's treatment of Palestinians in the occupied territories to South Africa under apartheid. Being able to voice criticism of Israeli government policy is becoming a major issue on university campuses across the United States. It's also an issue in Congress. We now turn to a well-known Israeli journalist for a sense of what this and other debates look like inside Israel. Akiva Eldar is the chief political columnist and senior analyst for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. And he's co-author of a new book. It's critical of Israeli settlement policy. It's called Lords of the Land, the Settlers and the State of Israel. I interviewed Akiva Eldar last month and asked him how the so-called Israel lobby in the United States is perceived in Israel.
They are a very important instrument in order to pursue Israel's policy, but I'm afraid that they're a little bit behind the Israeli government and the Israeli people. We are in a different mode, which I think takes time for the American Jewish organizations to digest the fact that we don't want to keep those territories. And probably the Israeli propaganda was so efficient that it's very hard to now to change the mode and to convince them that it's a different era now. It's a different government. We have 70 out of 120 members of the Knesset who support the two-state solution based on the 67 lines. And, you know, if for 40 years you tell the Jewish community that Israel cannot afford to give up the territories that are important for Israel's security, just overnight to tell, sorry, we were wrong. No, we don't need those territories. It's probably, I remember, you know, those groups that were taken to the Golan Heights, for instance. We didn't mention Syria. But the Golan Heights, we told them we can't live without it. Because look at the geography or topography. They're sitting there and they were shelling the kibbutzim down there. And now, after all this time that they spent going to Capitol Hill and using their leverage to convince the American people not to put any pressure on Israel to give up the Golan Heights, now all of a sudden the Syrians are the good guys and we can get down to business with them? It's very difficult. I think that we are paying the price of having our PR doing a very good job for many years.
Would you say, then, the American Jewish organizations are presenting an obstacle to peace?
They are, I think, behind the Israeli people. And I think that the bottom line, if you measure this by the results, I don't think that the mainstream Jewish organizations, there are others like Americans for Peace Now, IPF, Israel Policy Forum, Brit Tzedek V'Shalom, and other organizations who are doing a good job. And I think that they are getting more and more listeners.
What kind of effect did President Carter's book have in Israel?
You know, this is a kind of overkilling. I think that it's like Marsheimer and Waltz. The book
on the Israel lobby.
On the Israeli lobby. Just to say that Israel and the Jewish lobby controls the United States is overdoing it. They are very powerful. And I think that Israel and the Jewish lobby, are playing according to the American rules. You know, when I moved to Washington to be bureau chief of Haaretz, I got a tip from a colleague. I said, if you want to succeed, if you want to understand America, follow the money. And Jewish lobby has the money and has the motivation and has the power. And they use this. And Washington, as you know better than me, is a city of power. And if you have the power, nobody is disturbing the Arab lobby to use the same kind of power. There are 6 million Jews who live in the United States and more or less 6 million Muslims who live here. And it's a free country.
Why do you think would you say that the Israel lobby is more powerful?
Because they are more committed. I think that they are very committed to Israel security and well-being of the Israelis. And they are motivated to work and to invest.
Do you think they're making Israel more secure?
No. I think that they have good intentions, but, you know, sometimes where good intentions are taking people.
Let me ask you about former U.N. Ambassador John Bolton's comments declaring the Bush administration would support an Israeli attack on Iran. In an interview with an Israeli newspaper, Bolton said, quote, "We're talking about a clear message to Iran. Israel has the right to self-defense, and that includes offensive operations against WMD facilities that pose a threat to Israel. The United States would justify such attacks," he said.
I'm not sure if an attack on Iran is in the cards, simply because I don't think the United States and Israel know exactly where they're hiding the facilities. Iran is a huge country. They have a big desert. And as far as I understand, both the Israeli and the American intelligence don't know where they're hiding this. You can do this, what we did
in... That didn't stop an attack on Iraq.
Exactly. But this was different. You can do this only once. What we did, you mean Israel, in 81, attacking Iraqi nuclear facilities in Ostiraq. The Iranians are not going to repeat the same mistake. They are not putting all their eggs in one basket. They have too many baskets all around. And as far as I know from my sources, a military attack is not possible. What is possible is to reach an agreement with Iran and with other Arab countries, because it's not going to stop with Iran. I interviewed King Abdullah of Jordan 6 months ago. And he said, in no time, you will see every Arab country with nuclear power, including Jordan. Now, it starts, of course, with nuclear power for civil use. But you don't know where it ends and what will happen if there will be a coup d'etat in one of those Arab countries in a few years. So the Middle East is going to be nuclearized in no time. And I think that the solution should be a regional agreement. I wonder why the Arab League didn't offer to add another paragraph to their initiative from that started in 2002 and was ratified recently, that the Middle East should be nuclear-free, including Israel. And I think this has to be part of a regional agreement. From talking to Iranians, the message that is coming out of the most liberal Iranians, not only from Ahmadinejad, is that why shouldn't we have what we think the Israelis have, Pakistan and India? If Iran will agree to stop their nuclear program, that means that they admit that they are pariah, that they are worse than other countries. So I think we need to offer them a ladder where they can climb down. And this ladder, I believe, is a regional agreement. And of course, that means that Iran will have to stop putting out clear threats to the very existence of Israel.
So you're saying that Israel should give up its nuclear weapons. You have people like Mordechai Vanunu, the nuclear whistleblower who's been resentenced again after serving, oh, many years in jail.
As part of a regional peace process, a regional peace agreement, as long as Israel's existence is under threat, I don't believe that you can find any Israeli government that will agree to that. But actually, this has been the Israeli position when Shimon Peres was prime minister. The official Israeli position was that we will join the NPT and any kind of
nuclear proliferation treaty
once the Arab-Israeli conflict or the Middle East conflict, including the threat from Iran, will be over. Not a minute before that. Because of the need of Israel to keep whatever people believe that it keeps in Dimona, to deter a war.
How many nuclear bombs does Israel have?
I don't know.
But you know it does have them.
That's according to our policy. When I write about this, and this is what I have to do now, is to quote the foreign media. But according to foreign media, Israel has got nuclear power.
Explain that policy.
The policy is that we have in Israel military censorship. And there is an agreement between the military censor and the editors of the Israeli papers that when it comes to sensitive issues, we have to submit every story to the censor, such as the last occasion of when the Syrians claimed that the Israeli airplanes penetrated and attacked some units in Syria. We had to quote the Washington Post, CNN, and the Syrian papers.
And your understanding of what happened there?
Yes, I do.
What happened?
According to foreign sources.
You're in the United States now. Do you still have to abide by?
I'm afraid so. You don't want to put me into trouble, right? I have to go back to Israel. Well, if you offer me asylum, then maybe I will consider it. But my children are waiting for me at home. So you'll have to forgive me.
So can you explain what happened according to these sources?
According to these sources, Israel got information from good sources that Syria is hiding nuclear facilities that were transferred from North Korea. I understand that this happened before the agreement between the United States and North Korea. And since Israel had a clear proof that Syria is hiding this, and Israel had the opportunity to send Syria a message that this is just the beginning, that they can't do this, that Israel cannot come to terms with the idea that such cooperation will take place, the Israeli Air Force attacked those units.
What would happen if you defied the censor?
My editor and my newspaper will be fined. I don't think that I will go to jail, but there will be a big fine.
What do you make of the criticism when people in the United States criticize the Israeli government or the Israeli military that they are being anti-Semitic?
Look, some people may... If this book, Lords of the Land, was written by an American journalist, two American journalists, I'm sure that they would be blamed of anti-Semitism, like President Carter was blamed of being anti-Semite. I think that we are doing great damage to anti-Semitism when we use it in the wrong time and in the wrong context, because there is anti-Semitism. And it's going to be, you know, the cry, the wolf's cry, once there will be anti-Semitism. And I'm afraid it's not, you know, the end. Nobody will listen to us. So I would be very careful not to inflate the use of anti-Semitism whenever there is criticism. For instance, you know, for many years, people were talking about a Palestinian state and negotiations with the PLO. When I was writing articles in the 80s, in the beginning of the 80s, in favor of negotiations with the PLO and the two-state solution, some people called me a collaborator with the Palestinians. And if I was not Jewish, I'm sure I would be titled anti-Semite.
What do you make of the Arab League renewing their peace offer? Full peace for full withdrawal. Israel rejected it the first time. What about now?
You know, in November, we are going to celebrate 90 years of the Balfour Declaration, which was the first most important document offering a Jewish state to the Jewish people, a state in Israel. I think that the Arab League Declaration, 90 years later, is closing the circle that started, because the Balfour War, the Balfour Declaration started actually another round of violence because the Arabs were not willing to accept the idea of a Jewish state. 90 years later, the Arabs are completing what Balfour started. And I think that this is the best news that we had in 90 years. And I think it is not only stupid, I think it's criminal to miss this opportunity. I hope that the generations will come will not regret this.
Akiva Eldar, the chief diplomatic columnist and senior analyst for the Israeli daily newspaper Haaretz. He's co-author of a new book published on the 40th anniversary of Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. It's called Lords of the Land, The Settlers and the State of Israel. I interviewed Akiva Eldar when he came into our studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharifa Bokadous, Aaron Mate, Angelique Comet, Jeffrey Hagerman, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Ricardo Lobo, Harry Mache, Kizzy Cox, Mike DeFilippo, and Miguel Nogueira are engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Hugh Grant, Hani Massoud, Samantha Chambly, John Randolph, Laura Chipley, Rakan Penny, Vesta Godarz, and Rabia Agani. Our website is democracynow.org. There you can get our headlines, our segments, our transcripts, the video and audio podcast of our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.